there. I see you there. Thank you so much for popping in and for tuning in to the Create Your Purpose podcast, hosted by me, Quinn Tempest, where I'll share with you inspiring stories, conversations, and insights that will help you create more purpose in your business and in your entire life. I am really looking forward to today's episode, mainly because I get to introduce you to a woman who really inspires me, and I think she'll do the same for you as well. Her name is Komal Shah, and she is an educational consultant and also soon to be author. Her first book comes out later this summer. And Komal actually started her career in the Teach for America program as a middle school educator, but she was left wanting more. She wanted more for her kids, for all kids. She wanted more out of the education system as a whole. And so in order to pursue this dream, to pursue this purpose, she went back to school. She attended the USC Marshall School of Business, where she received her MBA, very impressively. And so what she does today is she leverages her passion for education, her business expertise, and her personal conscious living practices to really act as a catalyst. And that's a word we dive into in this episode today. She acts as a catalyst to shift outdated educational paradigms, which we're all familiar with, and really transform the entire educational system for the betterment of all children. I first connected with Komal when she joined my Create Your Purpose Collective, and I've just seen her take off and really create her purpose in unique and really powerful world-changing ways. And this is really her purpose and her power and her vision is to use educational spaces to raise up conscious children and really equip them to later become conscious adults. So enjoy this episode, enjoy this interview, and just enjoy hearing how Komal has created her purpose in her business and her entire life.
We'll just dive right in because I'm super excited to chat with you.
Okay.
Because I have a lot of questions. Like, I know you,
yeah.
But I also feel like there's a lot in your story that I don't know. Like, for example, I was reading through your website today and I saw that you were actually a biology major to begin with. So maybe we can start there and just let me know like how that evolution happened, because I know you're such in the education space now. Like, how did you go from biology major to educational consultant focused on changing major paradigms in the education space?
Okay. Yes, definitely. I was on a podcast yesterday and we talked about them. They were like, wow, what an interesting story. I was like, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about it. Cause I went from acting to marketing and I would just love to know like what your journey was.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I think when you're like going into undergrad and you're going into a major, I think so many times we're so funneled through the process. We don't always know kind of what we're doing or why we're doing it. For me, like growing up, being good in science or being good in math was like pretty much perpetuated in my culture and my family, things like that. So that's why I decided to become a biology major, not really knowing why I chose it, but because it felt like a path other people had gone down. So maybe I wanted it too. And I was a pre-med major too, so which is hilarious because I don't like blood. That's fun.
Yeah, that's a stickler, like pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. But it was so funny because when I was an undergrad, you know, more than classes, I actually was on a dance team. So I was dancing a lot. And that's what invigorated me more than going to my classes. I think it was like already kind of there that something wasn't right. But obviously the urgency wasn't there until I was in my senior year and I was going, wait, like, what am I doing?
Oh, so you got that far with the major then?
Yes, I did. I did, which is hilarious because I didn't enjoy my classes. So I don't know really what I was thinking. But then it was interesting because I went to a trip with my family to India. We went kind of on this holy pilgrimage and I didn't want to go, hilarious enough. But there were a lot of students who were kind of like begging on the street, or children, young children begging on the street in the small villages we were visiting. And I remember one time I asked one of these little kids, I was like, why aren't you in school right now? Like, it's daytime and you're begging on the road. And she's like, we don't have school here. Like, there's no such thing.
At all.
No. I think at that point, something hit me in a way that I like didn't notice or know it had. And then coming back was when I went, oh, okay. Like, I think I want to do something different. I want to make an impact in a different way. Funny enough, I applied to Teach for America, but didn't know.
Like, basically right when you got back then?
I was like processing my, like, was working with my dad with my majors, and he was like frustrated. He's like, you're a biology major. Like, you need to figure out what you're trying to do with your life. And you're about to graduate. And here are the different healthcare professional, like, professions you could look into. And I was just like, none of this excites me. None of it. And I've been such a passion-filled person. I always follow my passions. I think for my dad, it was really hard to understand that. He's kind of just like, you just do something and you pick it and you just go for it. Like, why are you kind of in this uncertainty place? And then I vividly remember, because I was hosting or organizing a dance competition this weekend, and it was Friday afternoon, and I went on our career portal of UC Irvine, and it was like, Teach for America, final deadline.
Oh, wow.
I looked at my roommate and I was like, should I do this? Like, I have 2 hours before I go to this dance competition I'm running. Should I do this? She's like, well, you don't want to regret it. I was like, all right. So I literally applied like 2 hours before it was due and wrote about my experience in India and how it completely changed my life. And fast forward 2 months later, I got in.
Wow. Just on a whim, right before it was due. Had you known about it? Like, how did you hear about Teach for America? You just like landed on the site and was like, yep, this is it.
I've had a lot of moments like that. I've had moments where things kind of like keep showing up in my face and I just feel like I have to click on it. And in this case too, like it was on the career portal for a long time because Teach for America has rolling deadlines. There was one in October, you know, there's one throughout. This just happened to be the last one. It was kind of one of those things where something in me just said like, apply, like you should just do this. And it is now funny when I look back because it's like, I didn't even know much about it. Like they only accept 10% of their applicants.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a very small, like competitive, you know, people are really talking to recruiters. There's this entire process. And here I am just kind of applying on a whim. Let's see what happens. And, you know, for my interview process, I had to like stand in the front and teach a class to people. And there were recruiters there watching and seeing what I was doing. But it was just magical because obviously all of these things were aligning. And it wasn't until the summer when I started my training, we basically taught summer school. And it was in that moment that I stepped into the classroom and I was like, wow, like, I think this is like what I'm meant to do. This feels so good. I was just having a blast. And it was really hard, but I was learning so much. And it was just a community of people and everything was just kind of falling into place. And then within 2 months, I moved to the Bay and I stayed there for 5 years.
That's so cool. I love that though. And I almost want to like zoom in on these little moments because you're talking about like even speaking to the child in India and realizing they didn't have school, to applying, to walking into the first classroom, never really having done it outside of maybe dance, like teaching, and like almost having this click moment. I don't know how else to describe it. And I'd love to hear how you would describe it. But since I bike a lot and I was just on my bike quite a bit yesterday, it's like when you change the gear into the perfect gear for the terrain that you're on, it almost like just clicks and you like don't have as much resistance or you just have the perfect resistance and you're just kind of coasting and it just feels right. How would you describe those moments? Because I feel like those little clicks, those little clues, or those little clicks are clues, which is very hard to say fast. But how would you describe those moments and how has listening to them guided you to where you are now?
Yeah, it's a great question. A couple of things. I think one, we all actually have very strong intuition. All of us do. I think we are conditioned out of listening to it. We're told that you need to ask for permission to listen to what you want. And instead you need to get validation from others and people around you and what society wants and things like that, as we know. I think in a lot of ways, I've always had that, but this was probably the first time that it was very strong, right? Like to even sit in front of a career portal and be like, I think I need to apply this to this thing and I don't really know what it is, but I just think I need to do it. I mean, that's your intuition, right? There's no other word for it. But I will also say, I think those clicks come from knowing when things don't click. when you had been in place of just like misalignment. And it's like me going to class and not being excited. That was a not click moment. It's like you're studying for an exam and you have 300 flashcards and you're memorizing and you're going, this is not learning, but I still have to do it for this test tomorrow. That's not a click moment. I would say for me, at least, I had a click moment whenever I would dance. That was like my kind of grounding in terms of knowing something that fuels your fire, that excites you. Like when I'm on stage, it clicks. I'm performing, it feels invigorating. I'm so excited. And because I kind of had that in more of a hobby and, you know, in that space of the passion point, when it happened with my career, it was like, oh yes, this is also possible. But let me tell you, no one told me that was possible. I remember telling my parents all this time, I want a job that makes me feel like when I dance. And they were like, there, there, we'll see if that ever happens. Of course, it's like immigrant parents, they came here to survive. They're just doing the best they can. So they don't really understand that correlation. But for me, it was always that moment. So when I stepped into the classroom, it was okay, this just clicked. But it's also your strengths, right? Like I'm performing as a teacher. That's something I've done my entire life. I love building connections with human beings. That's a part of being a teacher. And then also it's like, I always led. I was always a leader, even in high school, and I led clubs and things, and I'm leading my classroom now. It's like everything kind of aligns. I just never thought it was a teacher. And the funny thing is no one even told me that was an option as a career in my life. No one told me you could go down that path because it was just not seen as a very professional or sophisticated profession, which is unfortunate. But it was like when I did, I'm like, oh my God, there's all these possibilities that people get robbed out of because they just are told it's not a possibility. It's really sad, but I'm just so lucky I found it.
Yeah. I mean, it took a lot of exploration, it sounds like, to find it. But I love what you said. You said, I wanted a career that made me feel like I felt when I danced. And I just think that's so interesting. Because I always liken like the click moments or that kind of statement to light. I say, follow your sparkle. Like what lights you up? Follow that sparkle. But then also what dims your light? What makes you feel drained, depleted, or almost like collapsing in on yourself? And then the third part of that is, what is the thing you wish you were doing that you're not doing? And I think becoming aware of those things that's not what we're taught in school. We're taught, and I think this is something I'd love to talk with you about in school, because this is your space. Like we're taught to hit benchmarks. We're taught to get grades. We're taught to gauge our worthiness based on those things. We're actually not taught to look inside and ask these questions, like what lights me up? What drains me? And obviously that's going to come with time and age and exploration. But I think that inner awareness and inner noticing is not something that's cultivated from a young age. How have you seen that come to life in your work? Because I know this is really your focus, is like education and bringing this into your child's or your kids' or your students' lives. Like, how have you seen almost your journey of noticing now coming into play with what you want to do professionally?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I think it's what I saw when I was in the classroom. Yes, I was a biology major, but I was a math teacher, funny enough.
Oh.
And I taught seventh grade math and sixth grade math. So I taught seventh grade math in the traditional public school where I work. And then after that, I was in a charter school for 3 more years and taught sixth grade math. And I also led a team of teachers during that time as well. Total of 5. And initially, I didn't feel that way. And I think that was because I was in the worst performing middle school in the district. And so there were just so many barriers that I had to encounter. It was more just like, how do I even rally the troops and build a culture in my classroom to make it a space that's safe for learning? I felt my first 2 years was more survival mode. And then after that, one thing I would always say though, is that I still loved what I was doing. It was just really hard. I decided that I needed to take care of myself and move into another school that would support me more, but I didn't want to leave the community I was working in because I really loved it. It was interesting because once I had more support and I kind of felt like I was like building my practice and my instructional practice, then it was moments where I had to go, wait, now that I got okay in what I'm doing and teaching, is this actually good for kids? It was like that added layer, I would say my third, fourth, and fifth year teaching, because at that point, Many of my students came from low-income families. They were on free and reduced lunches. They had a lot of trauma that they had encountered. And it was like, no one was talking about it. It was kind of just this moment where I could see my kids. Like, I'm such a feeler. Like, I could see my students when they would walk in when there were things that were bothering them. And I'm telling them to start this math lesson.
Right.
It was like such a disconnection. And so that was definitely a reality moment for me. And I say that because I was a good student growing up. I was conditioned to do well in school, get good grades, do well on tests to go to college. I was also conditioned by these benchmarks, as everyone else. So when you become a teacher, you expect the same thing from your students. And I think it takes a lot of self-awareness to go, wait, this may actually not be working for them. And also, I would say, is what we've been doing with children, you know, I always say children become adults. I think sometimes we forget that. Children become adults in our society. They're human beings. When I look at our society, and I'm constantly seeing people in jobs that don't fulfill them, constantly in jobs that they're disengaged, having mental health issues, having troubles personally, professionally, all of these things. And they've lost their inner voice. They're disconnected from who they are. They don't know what's going on or how to pursue something that excites them. We have to honestly ask ourselves, well, they were in our schooling system for 12 years. So like, what went wrong? Because what we're doing is obviously not working. Now, from a productivity, efficiency, workplace perspective, it's going well.
Great.
But like from a well-being perspective, it's not. And so I do think we've conditioned our schools in a certain way because we usually create it for the workforce. So if the workforce was or has been to kind of have workers who are going to come in and they're going to work long hours and they're going to support our company and they're going to be loyal to us, then them kind of following their inner voice, does that actually help your company? Maybe not. Maybe even if they feel disconnected from your culture, they're going to stay because they've been taught their entire schooling, you ask for permission before you want to do anything. Even if you don't like it, you do it because it's good. It's good for you. And this is what success looks like. So how do you battle that, right?
I feel this so much, Komal, because I was that student. Like, I was a perfectionist. I was a straight A student. If I got a B+, it was the end of the freaking world. And I just got really good at knowing what are the expectations of teachers. And, you know, it was always like this, like I get a bad grade, like quote unquote, my fingers are going on there. A bad grade, like the first test. And then I'd realize, okay, what is it the teacher wants? And then I would give that to them instead of being like, okay, what is the thing I'm really learning? And this ended up so badly for me. Like, I was such a perfectionist. And frankly, I got some of the best education. My parents sent me, well, I actually asked because I'm a goody two-shoe. I went to one of the best all-girls schools here in Phoenix. I had the privilege of going there. And I always said I had to unlearn so many bad habits from going there because I was so educated. I was so good at writing. I could do all of the things and tick all of the boxes. But what I couldn't do and what got me into trouble later in my first job was listen to myself, was to actually notice, Quinn, you're overworking. Quinn, you shouldn't drink and then do this thing. Quinn, you need to like calm the frick down. I don't know if I need to, I love to curse. I don't know how that works on podcasts. And then I had one of my click moments, which is why I identify with the one you talked about in India. Like, my click moment that I still distinctly remember, and I've shared this publicly before, is when I fell off my bike and I didn't feel anything. I was totally numb. I was empty. Like, I didn't feel physical pain. I didn't feel emotional pain. I didn't have tears. And that was the point when really everything from my child, everything came back. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know myself. I can't feel myself. I don't know what to do. And I think if I had been in your classroom or in the classrooms that you're trying to create through your business, I would have been equipped with the tools to notice more and notice sooner.
Yeah. And I think we also have to ask ourselves like what it means to be educated.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we're educated out of our true essence and into a certain model that serves the system. And I know that's a strong statement to make because I think that we've been told or taught that our education leads to success. So it's hard to look at that model and say that that thing that now serves me at this moment is actually something that maybe didn't serve me. That's scary for a lot of people. But I do think, including myself, by the way, like I'm constantly unlearning. Like I went to grad school. I'm a product of the system. I'm in it with everyone else, but I do have to question and ask myself that even in grad school, when I had so many peers who were still lost and confused, yet they were deemed successful based on societal standards, it's like, what are we measuring, right? Yeah. Because they still don't really know what they're doing. And I think our system and our schooling systems, even some of the most prestigious K-12 schools out there, a lot of it is kind of like following a certain model and like getting you into an Ivy League college. It's kind of asking yourself, is that truly the authenticity of that child and what they want to be? Or are you just trying to make sure that they fit this mold? That's a scary thing to look at, but I do think that's unfortunately what happens a lot of the time.
Well, then kind of jump us forward then, because you went for your MBA, you identified the problem, you did Teach for America, you saw it in the actual classroom, and then you had all those click moments. So how did you pull all of that together into what you're doing now?
I do have to say my other click moment is when I applied for business school in January and got in May. So,
wow, there you go. Another one.
I always tell people, they're like, your story is insane. People wait for 2 years to go. What are you doing?
Oh, really? I actually didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It's like people take time to go to business school. And I just like woke up one morning and like had a dream. I'm going to, you know, order GMAT books. My dad was like, why are you ordering GMAT books off of my Amazon account? And I was like, I think I'm going to go to business school. And he's like, in your fifth year teaching, I'm really confused.
Oh my God. Your dreams are a lot better than mine. Because if I were following my dreams, I would be doing a stand-up comedy show in my parents' bedroom. That was my dream last night. And I would win. It was a competition. I would win. I mean, your dreams are a little more effective than mine.
Yeah. I would say like, going to business school in a lot of ways, though, it's just another skill set and another perspective that actually I think a lot of people in education don't have. I do think that I'm really lucky that I got that. I was such a learner in that space. I had never taken any of these classes before, but you know, a lot of what business is all about, and now that we're business owners, we know this, like your customer or your client is your number one priority, and you have to kind of identify their pain points and support them to make sure that you build an offering or product or service that's actually going to serve them so they can come out better. And now if we put that same model in our schools,
right?
It's like, have we identified our children's pain points, or do we go, we've been using this curriculum for 10 years and it's fine. So like, we're just going to use it again. We're not going to ask you if it works. We're not going to ask you if it's relevant. We're not going to ask you anything. We're just going to do it because we've been always doing that. It's like from a business lens, you kind of have to go, oh my gosh, like, what are we doing?
Right. So this school is not running a good business.
Yeah. So in terms of putting everything together, as you know, I like started my business last year. To be honest, it was kind of like, I was creating a website. I was helping, working with my friend on building a vision for what I wanted. And it just kind of was like, I think I'm just going to start this and see what happens. I didn't really know. And then I joined a book program at the same time. And, you know, of course, Komal, who's too overly ambitious, was like, I can do both. It's going to be totally fine. Launch a business and also write a book. No, that's not how this works. It's like launching two businesses at the same time.
So. Oh, for sure.
Decided to focus on the book. But I just think now I've been given the gift of having two distinct perspectives that I can kind of mesh together and go, these are the problems I identified when I was on the ground. Hey, by the way, now that I have business skill sets, I actually know how we can create solutions and models that can actually support this organization to enhance the learning processes. I just feel really blessed that I have both of these and can kind of utilize that moving forward.
What would one of the solutions be? Because I know your big focus is on consciousness, and I think some people don't necessarily know what that word means. I think, you know, I come from a yoga tradition, so I know it's awareness and consciousness and cultivating that inner knowing and inner noticing. But can you maybe share a little bit about what one of those solutions is and how you've seen that play out in at least the schools or the kind of practices that you have been working with?
I do think one of the solutions that I've seen with the many people I've interviewed for my book is giving space and moving away from a culture of testing to a culture of learning. And I do think that there are a lot of schools out there, alternative schools that are doing this. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to see in the public school system, but I would say otherwise it's happening all the time. I say that because the public school system is so stifling. When you have a new space that's more about growth and learning and just you have space to reflect and play, I mean, that's consciousness in itself, because as we all know, you can't have awareness if you don't have the time and space to even sit down with yourself, right? Or even just be there and be in the present moment, not be rushing to the next class. I've seen that over and over again, which excites me. It's like, wow, people are really trying these different models to try to just build a bigger space for children and really giving them options. Not necessarily saying college is the only pathway, you know, they're kind of giving them different ways in which they want to move forward in their educational pathways, which is super exciting. Now, on a lens of just at people, if I look at like educators and, you know, district leaders and things like that, I mean, immediately I think is, when are we actually giving space to these stakeholders who are working with our students to self-reflect on their own educational experience?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I actually didn't realize that was an element. That's cool.
I think that we don't do it. I think that most of the time it's because we don't think there's a correlation. But as someone who was a teacher myself, let me tell you, there's a strong correlation because it's all unconscious. If, for example, for me, like I was a really good student. So when I'm in the classroom as a teacher, I'm going to see everyone who is a student like me, that they're good, and everyone who is kind of challenging it or having behavior problems, that they're a problem. And it's unconscious. I don't even know that I'm doing that, but it's because those students look like me and what I did. And then you also have, oh, Komal was like obedient and not as outspoken. So now if you have students who are kind of outspoken, it's kind of like this moment of, oh, why does this make me feel uncomfortable? Where is this stemming from? I think that a lot of times, unfortunately, we're not taught at all to reflect on our own educational experience. And most professional development for teachers tends to be, how can you enhance the student's learning? Or how can you implement a new strategy? But as we know in servant leadership, like first you have to start with self, right? You have to fill your own cup. So where is the PDs around like self-reflection on yourself? And like, why are you even in this space? What invigorates you? How has your experience maybe negatively affected a child? Maybe we need to unpack that a little bit. If the strategies and all of that are great in terms of data and enhancing test scores, but how about the relationship you're building with your students? Like, what does that look like? I think that's like a really missing element, unfortunately.
Well, I think it's interesting. I have a few friends, close friends that are teachers, educators, and I have just always been fascinated by hearing about their work. And frankly, and I hope this doesn't sound too harsh, it sounds awful. Like most of the time, I'm just like, this sounds awful to hit these benchmarks, to deal with the politics of the school. And then, of course, what you're talking about, and I think this is interesting too, in just the general conversation of the past year, is our unconscious biases. And obviously that's been brought to light in terms of race and race equity and economic equity. But I think what you're bringing up is another layer of it is educational bias. How have you had an experience, or how is your experience biasing what is happening in the classroom, which your argument is fundamental to how we are raising children to become adults in our society, and it's formative.
Yeah, first of all, that's another thing. Like, I don't want to put the onus on just the teachers because
it's... No, it's a system.
It's a system, and that's the issue. And so many people have tried to dismantle it and to create something different and revolutionize it. And then what happens is they end up starting as something on their own because they realize it's helpless. And that's what really saddens me, because not everyone has the access to go into these alternative schools. So now they're being funneled into a system that's not going to actually support them. And I don't know where we have thought it's okay to test our children this much. Like, that was never the purpose of school. It's about learning. And somehow we've taught them that your entire year is about the end of the year state assessment that you're going to do. And the school is only really pushing that because that's how they're going to get funded for the next year. And it's like, what are we doing? I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. And now you're pressuring teachers to teach it. I remember making my pacing guides, like it was god awful.
A pacing guide, that's what it's called?
Oh yes, where you're like unit planning and lesson planning and making sure that by May you teach all these 5 units, and also you have diverse learners in your classroom and you're trying to get them to fit this one pace, which as we know is not normal. And right. So it's just like, none of it makes sense. When I'm talking about it, I'm hoping to really also humbly say, I don't know all of the solutions, but what I do know is that this is not working. And what I'm doing is to go beyond the achievement gap and beyond the college disparities that we see between those who come from low income statuses to the elite and the wealthy, because there are a lot of amazing, good people that are doing that work, and I commend them. But I'm trying to create a new vision to really say, here's my big idea, like how we're educating children, is this even working? And are we even focusing on this element of the within and the inner awareness? And if we're not, I think we really need to relook at it, because I think that's what's leading to a lot of the problems we see in our society right now. And I can see that in my head, but obviously articulating that to someone who's never really thought about it can be difficult.
But I think this is a perfect transition into your purpose.
Yeah.
Because you've been a member of my collective for a while. So we really dive individually into your purpose. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but on my purpose quiz, you got the catalyst. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that. Because for anyone listening, I have this quiz. It's called the purpose quiz. And it's really just helping women or anyone identify their entrepreneurial purpose and that underlying drive that really moves them to create. One of the types, which is actually a really rare type, I think it's maybe the second least received, or maybe the least, I have to look that up, is the catalyst. And the catalyst is all about igniting change and also being a visionary. And I think you even just said that. You said, I'm trying to create a new vision. And I'm trying to articulate that to people so that we can move things forward. Tell me more about your purpose and how you see your role in this realm, and also how kind of understanding your catalyst nature maybe helped you refine and define what impact you want to make.
I love taking your purpose quiz because I never thought of the word catalyst before. When I took it, I was like, oh, that's a cool word that I need to keep using. First of all, I think the biggest thing I've realized too is, especially when you're a catalyst, it gave me some sense of obviously language, but to understand that sometimes when you're pushing status quo, it takes time. And I really needed to hear that. Like, I think that this journey I'm on is not like, hey, I wrote a book and now everything's going to change in education. Like, this is going to take years, and it's going to take maybe even years beyond my lifetime, right? I've kind of humbled myself and known that. And I also like the word catalyst because sometimes it's a spark, right? It's a spark in someone else, but it's not necessarily that you're trying to change someone. Because something I've learned, it's like the age old thing, is you can't change people, right? They have to change themselves. But how can you ignite something in them or spark something in them or inspire something in them that's going to allow for that to actually reflect and think and move forward? That was just really great language-wise. In terms of my purpose, I love the stuff that you've said around just like why and not the what, because I think like it's so easy to get into the what, but now that I know that my why, and I think my purpose statement is something like I catalyze inner transformation or something.
I think I ignite change. I think you ignite change.
Yes, I ignite change through inner transformation, and it's kind of like, oh, that can be so many different things. So even within the educational space, like right now I'm an educational consultant, I also know that may change and that's okay. I don't have to be so scared about that. Or with my book, it's like, I can look at this book from 5 years from now and be like, oh, there's a lot of things that I've evolved and changed based on what I said in that moment and that time. I think that's been super amazing as well. But in terms of purpose, I don't know. I just, as everything I've always said, it's just like alignment in that moment. And now I listen to my intuition more than ever before. And I do, to your point, go after things that kind of like make me feel excited and like light me up versus doing things that kind of dim my light. And I'm also just open to more experiences because I just feel so grounded in this is my why. Now, whatever like kind of comes my way, I'm just seeing if it resonates with that. And if it does, great. If it doesn't, then I'm moving on to the next thing.
Oh, you're just like making my day right now. I'm just all lit up because you get it. And I'm so happy that people can hear you say this. I just want to highlight, spotlight a couple of things that you said, is that purpose is not what you do. For instance, even like there is a purpose quiz result called the educator. And I'm honestly so glad you didn't get that, Because a lot of people, when they get that result, they think they have to be a teacher. Mm. And I'm like, no, you can be anything. It's the underlying drive to educate, or in your case, it's the underlying drive to ignite change. And how you're doing that is through education. And how that can come to life, it can, purpose and why can come to life in so many whats. Like you said, right now it's coming to life in your book, where you interviewed, 70 different experts on alternative education. It's coming to life through consultation with schools and educators. And maybe in the future, hey, you can create your own school, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that is so freeing when you know that purpose isn't just one thing. And it also doesn't define who you are or what you do. It's this broad, resonant, sparkly statement that can drive you to do so many things, because you're not limited. You're limitless. And I think so many people like to put purpose in a box when purpose is literally everything outside of it.
I love that. I love the word limitless, right? Because I feel that way now, even if someone asks me, like, what's going to happen after the book? And I'm like, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'm so much more expansive. And I also love my purpose statement too, because in so many ways, it also leads my personal life. Like, if I want to ignite change through inner transformation, well, I better get my butt on a seat and like sit with my own inner self and work through my own things and transform myself constantly. I think sometimes we forget about the personal aspect of it as well, which can also be there.
But I think that's a perfect point. And this is something I've seen so much with the members of the Create Your Purpose Collective, is that the person and the people who need our purpose the most is usually ourselves first. For example, my purpose is I help people bring their ideas to life. And that's because for so long, I couldn't bring my own ideas to life. I ignored my ideas. I flitted them away. I just dimmed their sparkle and dimmed my own. And I think that's often a really great place to look if you're trying to uncover what your purpose could be, is what either riles you up the most, or what makes you so mad, or what is the thing you crave the most? Like, for the longest time, I craved to have something to call my own. I wanted to build something that was impactful, that was creative, that was magical. And I didn't know what that was, but I just had this like insatiable craving and urge to find out. And that ended up obviously being Create Your Purpose and the collective and, you know, this podcast and these type of connections. But I think oftentimes the people who need our purpose the most first is ourselves. And when we can become the master of our own purpose, that's when we can make a true impact out there in the world.
I love that. And I also think there's something to say is that it's unfortunate, because I think we've all been conditioned, and I say this, including myself, that who you are is not enough. There's also this idea that just living is, that's also like, okay. I think we've been taught that you have to have outcomes and you have this and you have to have this in order to be valued in the world. And it's like, that's not true. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's so hard, because every message we ever get is, what are you doing? What are you reaching? What is next? What are the expectations you're fulfilling? Are you going to get that promotion? It's never ending. And so we have this like vicious voice telling us all the time. But it's like, if you can even ground yourself in a phrase like this, you can also just go be more abundant and kind of just allow things to come your way, and also just try and experiment and not feel so confined and just kind of go with it without trying to see how is it going to help you? What is it going to do for you? Sometimes it doesn't need to do anything. You're just experiencing it to go another way.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that. I'm getting better. It's like a journey, you know? But even this week, a couple days ago, I took myself in the morning to a cute little coffee shop. And I just read for an hour before I opened up my email, before I worked, before I did anything. And I literally did it to like force myself to get more comfortable doing things like that. Because my inner drive is such a slave driver. It's just such a motor. And I think we're probably very similar in that way. I know.
But I know. Inside, I was like, I get it.
Yeah, you get it. Like, inside the collective, we actually just read the four tendencies, and both you and I are upholders. So we meet our inner expectations and outer expectations. But the problem that sometimes arises with that is that we have so many expectations for ourselves that we don't let ourselves just be. And so I am trying to, which is ironic, right? I am trying to be, I don't know, I'm like trying to force myself to like be not as crazy by doing less. I don't know how to articulate that.
Yeah, I get it though. It's a balance of being versus doing. And believe me when I say I'm learning too, right? It's like if I have a day and I'm not doing anything, and I put that in quotation marks because you are doing something, which is you may just be sitting and that is still doing something. But it's like, how do you take that moment and go, I'm still being productive. Like, this is actually okay. Like, this is actually fine. And it is, it's kind of like a mind warp. And interesting, I've seen recently is sometimes I play down the work I put into things. And it's kind of fascinating. Like, I was telling my brother, because I've been on like 10 podcasts, right, up until now. And I was telling him, I'm like, oh, it's such serendipity. Like, it's just so amazing that all these like podcasts have come my way and all these people want to chat with me. And I'm like part of all these projects and stuff. And he kind of was just like, yeah, but you also like put in the work. You put your voice out there. Like, you decided to do this thing and you've done that. And that's what, this is the result of that. Also acknowledge that. Like, it's not like it just came your way. You also did things to make that happen. And I was, oh yeah, but if I negate the work that I put in, then that excuses me to keep working and keep grinding because like it never ends. So it's like this weird psychology moment.
I feel you. I think A, you need to celebrate the wins, but I think celebrating is for many of us hard. It's something we have to cultivate and work on. And you know, it's something I've even built into my own reflection process every month is just like to celebrate something. It could be small. It could be big, and just give myself an affirmation because it doesn't come naturally to me to celebrate myself. It comes naturally to me to celebrate other people, but not necessarily myself. And I think just what you're talking about being versus doing, like that is every weekend for me. And it's something I'm really working on because I'll have a busy week, right? I'll get to Saturday and I just feel almost anxious and a little rude to, you know, my husband or whatever, because I don't know what to do with myself. I have a full day of nothing planned and I sit there and have to face myself and I don't know how to do that sometimes. And I'm getting better at it. Like, I'm cultivating certain practices, like ending work on Friday a little early, like cleaning up my space. But when I don't have something to do, I realize I want to just fill that space immediately because I can't just sit with myself. And it's going to be a lifelong practice, I know, but it's something I've noticed more and more, especially during the pandemic. Well, many of us, at least the people who had privilege to just be and like had a lot of extra time, a lot of shit came up when there was time and when there was space. And it's weird.
No, I mean, I really resonate with what you said. And I think it's also important to know that a lot of times we're distracting ourselves. I see myself doing that all the time. So to sit with yourself is uncomfortable. Like, what can I do? What can I do to distract myself? Because if I distract myself, I'm going to just go outside, or I'm going to go hang out with my friends, or I'm going to like watch like anything than just like,
it's a checklist.
It's a checklist. And a lot of times I know for me, a lot of it's because I'm avoiding like an emotion that's quite uncomfortable. And I really just don't want to sit with it. I just don't want to do that to myself. But it's in those moments, I always turn it off. And I was actually talking to someone yesterday on this podcast. We were talking about wellness. And we've actually been talking a lot about how in our Western culture, we've been taught just like everything else, there's an outcome. With wellness, you do something, you do X, you feel Y. You do yoga, you're going to feel just rejuvenated and just relaxed and safe. Meditation, same thing. You're going to come out, you're going to feel calmer. All of this stuff, it's always about outcomes. But it's like I was talking about, we need to reframe that. You know, we need to reframe wellness going, I sat in meditation. It was really uncomfortable. And I realized I have some stuff I need to work through. That's wellness. That is wellness. You're not supposed to feel happy all the time. Like, you're supposed to check in with yourself. Like, that is really what wellness is. But it's a trip.
I love the idea of a checklist that we kind of just came up with, because that's totally what it is for me. Okay, I've checked all these. I worked out. I walked to the farmer's market. I went on 3 walks. I got my steps in. I drank this much water. I did my work. It's all done. And I'm like, oh no, now what? That is really where the work begins for me, is that space.
Totally fair. Totally.
Well, you have something coming up that I want to give you a chance to talk about, because you have your book coming out, oh my God, in August.
Yes.
So can you tell everyone a little bit about that process and what's happening next? Because I know you like blew away your pre-order campaign, which I'm super excited about. Let us know about that and how people can connect with you.
Yeah. The Working Tall, my book, is bringing consciousness to education. I will be changing it soon, actually. So now everyone knows who's listening to this. I guess like the process itself, I was in a book program that I joined called Creator Institute. So anyone who's ever wanted to write a book, you can look it up on Google. And it's actually led by a Georgetown professor. His name is Eric Custer. Again, serendipity for me. So a friend like told me about it. I applied, didn't think about it. 2 months later, we had a chat and then I decided to do it. But it was really interesting, just the book process itself, because I do think a lot of people who feel like they want to share their voice or write a book, they get stuck. And a lot of times the stuck comes from one is fear, as with anything. But then there's also this need for perfection, which kind of relates to what we're talking about. So it's like, if I write, it needs to be a certain way. It needs to look a certain way. And he even says that's the issue that so many writers face, but all you really need to do is just write.
That can apply to life.
Yeah. And he also said that what most authors fail to do is realize that you should build structure later. So your table of contents needs to be later. Your chapters need to be later. You just need to be gathering stories and interviewing people and writing based on what you're hearing from others. And then you construct later. All the things that we've not been taught to do, like in our thesis papers growing up, but it's everything that he's kind of teaching us. I spent the first few months doing that, just writing. Then I moved into the chapters. I submitted my first manuscript March 5th, and then it was being kind of seen by the publisher. And at that moment, I was doing my pre-launch campaign, which is what you mentioned. A lot of that money goes to cover my publishing costs. It was just the first time I've had to market, and like it felt like a launch, and it was amazing. I feel really blessed of just all the support that I received. It was pretty great. And now I'm in revisions. So, you know, it never ends. I think also what people see on the outside, they're like, your book is done. Oh, it's actually not done. You know, now I'm literally going back in and revising it. And our professor always says the best books are rewritten. He's really big on you're going back in and you're looking at your writing. And what I've realized too is my writing's so much better now.
That's good.
You know, when I was writing in like November, December, right? It's like your stories maybe don't seem that exciting or relevant. But I have beta readers, so they're reading through my manuscript and giving me feedback as well. So that's like a vulnerable moment, is having other people see your creative pieces and tell you this is maybe not working or whatever it is. But it's set to publish in August. It's going to come out on Amazon and any other bookstores as well. People want to connect with me or just follow with my book journey. I'm actually really active on LinkedIn. You can just connect with me on there. But all my handles everywhere are Consult Komals. You can pretty much find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those things. And I also have a website as well. It's just thekomalshaw.com if you want to know more. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at in my journey. A little bit more time working on the book for sure.
I'm super excited for it. If anyone wants to watch her video, this like trailer for the book, for the pre-order, and it's really cool. It's like 4 minutes, but I think you get a really good look into kind of the ideas behind all of this. It's very interesting. I'm excited for it. Definitely go find Komal on Instagram, LinkedIn. Well, LinkedIn's your main one, and her website too. But I'd love to end with, and I didn't prep you for this, but maybe it's a little more fun that way. Just a few rapid fire questions, just a few quick ones. First and foremost, what is the one routine or ritual that keeps you sane?
I'm trying to think about the routine that I do at night that I'm trying to do, or like something that I actually do every day. But I would say probably more so than ever before is meditating in the morning before I do anything.
I do that too. I've done it for years, but I've been using Peloton lately, which is really nice because they just have like 10 minute, 15 minute. And it's just nice to kind of have that. And I also get badges. It's like kind of gamified, which is fun. All right. What does being a purpose-driven entrepreneur mean to you?
It just means that you are grounded in your why. I really do think that's all it is. I think that the only difference between a purpose-driven entrepreneur and one is not, is that you're just grounded in something, which I think just makes you have better discernment with decisions. It makes you kind of follow your intuition and kind of what feels aligned. And I also think that it allows you to not repurpose, but kind of evolve your purpose over time as well. Because if you feel so grounded in something, and if you keep having moments in misalignment, maybe you can also look at your purpose and see what needs to shift. But I just think it's something that pushes you in any direction, but makes you feel, you know, you're leading with something bigger than yourself in some ways.
Yeah, no, I think discernment and evolution, spot on. That's what I would have said.
Yeah.
What is one main value that guides your life and business? For example, like one of mine is creativity and curiosity.
I would say just abundance. Yeah.
I like that.
And kind of surrender too. I know those sound very fluffy, but those are very philosophical words to say. But I do think like I've done better in my entrepreneurial journey so far is because I haven't been so attached to my outcome.
Oh, but that's huge. I mean, we could do a whole episode on that, is like acting and releasing expectations of results. That is such a great lesson for life, but especially entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I would even give an example. My pre-launch campaign, you know, my dad is very analytical. So he would ask me like, what's your goal? Like, what are you trying to reach? And of course he had benchmarks by the publishing company, but I even told him, I was like, that's a limitation of my mind. Like, I'm not going to put a goal on it because maybe I'm going to make more than that.
And you did.
I did. But if I had told myself I'm going to make 8K and that's it, then that's maybe what would have happened. But because I just kind of was like, we'll see. And it ended up being more than I ever thought.
I approach it a little differently. I do 3 goals to manage my expectations. So I do a base goal, like the thing I know I want to hit and I almost need to hit. And then I do a stretch goal, which is just a little bit of an expansion and what I would be really excited. And then I do a unicorn goal. And it's just really magical, amazing. Like it would just make me feel on the top of the world. I know I might not hit it, but like if I do, I get like a cool, what is this called? A horn. I get a magical horn.
Amazing.
I wish you could see this. I do that just to manage my expectations, because otherwise I feel like if I just do one goal, I don't feel good with that.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting with business how I handle that, because I keep reminding myself that we do have limitation of mind. And like we always base things based on our previous thought patterns. If I had told myself this year, I'm going to be on like 5 podcasts, but it's like that I didn't even make a goal for myself. And it was interesting to see what came my way that was like beyond my expectations. I'm like navigating that, right? Like, how do you set benchmarks and stuff for yourself? Because you do need that tangibly in a business. But then how do you also not limit yourself in the process? I'll see how that navigates moving.
Yeah. And I also think it depends where you are in your business. I think right now for you, it's fine to keep it open and just experiment. I think for me, when I started doing my 3 goals, like the base goal is actually a financial necessity. There are certain things that I need to hit if it's a revenue-based goal. And then the rest is like, you know, cherry on top. And then there also are goals, like you mentioned, oh, I want to get on 5 podcasts. Like if you attach that to like, okay, because I need to expand my reach, and this is the action that will take me there. That's one way to think about it. But I used to be the same way. I'm like, I'm just going to like see what happens and try this out. Like, I think it just depends where you are in your business and what the goal is footing to. Well, we went past rapid fire, but I like this. Okay, 3 more. What is the biggest mistake you've made in your business? Knowing that it's most likely not a mistake, but it's something you learned from.
Doing too much at the same time. I think you're really ambitious when you start. Yeah, doing too much at the same time, realizing you can break it up and you don't have to do everything at once.
What is the single best thing you've ever done in your business?
Committing to something and going for it, even if you're uncertain about it.
Yes, please. Take action. The clarity will build the more you do. And lastly, other than your amazing book coming out in August, what is one book you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, it hasn't come out yet, but I do have to shout out a company that I interned for. The CEO just came out with a book called Going First. It's on Amazon right now for $1. And it's all about purposeful leadership.
Oh.
Very aligned. And she has amazing frameworks. If you are leading a cause or in a big company or an entrepreneur, like how do you lead with purpose?
Well, I love that. And I think that's the perfect place to end the Create Your Purpose podcast. With a reference to more purposeful resources.
Yeah.
Thank you, Komal, for being here. Everyone, go follow her, connect with her, see what she's doing in the education space, because I'm sure her purpose will evolve and we're all excited to see what she does next.
Thanks.
That is all we have for you today on the Create Your Purpose podcast, but I just personally want to thank you for showing up, for listening, and for exploring purpose with me. If you haven't yet subscribed, make sure you do that wherever you get your podcasts so you can get a notification when our next episode goes live. In the meantime, give me a follow. I'm over on the gram, as the kids say these days. So find me at quinn.tempest, where I share lots more about purpose and lots more about purpose-driven entrepreneurship as well. Until then, keep making magic, keep following that sparkle, and keep creating purpose.